Hello, and welcome to the New World. Episode 9, Aztec Dominion. A brief side note before we begin. I've had the podcast's website, historyoftheneworldpodcast.wordpress.com, up for about a month now, but I've only just started posting to it today. It's a map of the expansion undertaken by Aztec emperors, which I meant to post last time. It's really handy. You should go look it up. Remember, that's historyoftheneworldpodcast.wordpress.com. Nice and short, right? Well, last time, I gave a brief history of the Aztec Empire, from the founding of Tenochtitlan in 1325 to the state that it was in under Moctezuma II in 1518, just before the landing of our friends the Spanish. Today, I wanted to bring things to a halt, take out our microscopes, and examine Tenochtitlan in detail. I want to talk about some noteworthy stuff I picked up during my research, from the Aztec religion to their education, their warfare to their city planning. By getting a look at what the average person of this time was like, we can get a much better sense of what's happening here and what's about to be lost as well. So, here is an admittedly short episode about life in the Aztec Empire. By the year 1518, about 400,000 people lived in Tenochtitlan and the surrounding suburbs. The city spanned over 5 square miles and was made up of hundreds of artificial lakes, built out from the original spot where the Mexica first witnessed an eagle devouring a snake. Though it was all on the water, one could approach the city on land, via several causeways connecting Tenochtitlan to its outlying cities. Among those were Tlacateco to the south, Tlacopan to the east, and Tepeyacac to the north. Even if you were walking down a causeway, you'd likely see dozens of boats zooming all around the city and through its canals like beetles on water. Any one of these causeways could lead you directly to the city's central plaza. Here were the huge 200-foot-high pyramids devoted to Tlaloc, the god of rain, and Huitzilopochtli, the war god and patron god of the Mexica. All around it were various markets and palaces, built by different emperors, not too dissimilar from how a Roman forum was laid out. Also similar to a Roman city was the fact that most of Tenochtitlan's streets were set in a grid system, with fairly straight and interconnected roads, and bridges connecting each of the city's 4 main districts, as well as the by now very interconnected city of Tlatelolco. Tenochtitlan had grown so quickly in the 1470s, that officials were able to plan its layout in a way uncommon to the old towns of medieval Europe. Oh, by the way, I have a map posted to the WordPress website if you're curious. As I said, the city had 4 main districts, 5 if you count Tlatelolco, which you probably should. Each district was itself divided among the Calpoli, clan-based neighborhoods led by the noble Pipiltin families. The commoner Machahualtin families paid tribute to the upper-class Pipiltin through their daily jobs, while the Pipiltin managed their efforts. Calpoli had their own officials who could store tribute, organize infrastructure, and act as local judges. As far as the law goes, there wasn't anything written down, but laws were generally understood. Things like murder, adultery, and slavery had punishments that most people knew about. There was also a supreme court of sorts where people could take their grievances, whether they be noble or commoner. Your average Calpoli house had a flat roof, usually used for a garden, and a central courtyard. Speaking of gardens, the palaces left behind by every emperor often contained botanical gardens of their own, or even zoos filled with animals from other places who paid tribute to them during their reigns. Each Calpoli also had a marketplace. Markets were a central facet of life in Tenochtitlan. As the capital of the empire and the final destination of most tribute payments, the amount and variety of goods to be found in the city was staggering. Each merchant had their own stall and had their goods well organized. Calpoli had smaller markets, but Tenochtitlan also featured several large marketplaces in the central plaza. As for the things you could find, let me just quote Camilla Townsend outright. One part of the market featured luxury goods, gold and silver, turquoise, jade, and other gems, the feathers of exotic birds. Merchants sold these to artisans as raw materials, and to wealthy customers as finely crafted textiles and beautiful jewelry. Likewise, they sold plain cotton thread or cloth, and also beautifully made embroidered cloaks and other clothing. In another area, they offered firewood and lumber, as well as wood carved into tool handles, paddles, and columns for buildings. They sold copper axe heads and needles, white bark paper, pitch pine for torches, rubber balls, herbal medicines, tobacco, pipes, row upon row of ceramic pots and dishes. They hawked goods made of sisal, twine, rope, nets, and sandals, as well as all manner of animal furs, tanned or untanned, dyed or undyed. They sold rough grinding stones and fine obsidian knives or mirrors, in which one could see every detail of one's face. In one corner, men could pay to have their hair cut. In another, they could buy a slave or find a prostitute. Townsend also goes on to talk about the amount of food one could find. Of course, it was pretty much everything the Mesoamerican people ate, both plants and animals. Tlatelolco was famous for having something akin to fast food restaurants, where food was partially made already for those without the time to roll tortillas or cut vegetables. Markets also had a collection of places for human waste, i.e. urine. This kept the streets clean somewhat, but it also allowed the market's merchants to utilize the ammonia in human urine for their work projects, like tanning. Officials walked around ensuring the commerce was well regulated. These government employees were also often women, as women were also the chief buyers and sellers of goods. So the people of Tenochtitlan had access to almost anything that could be found in Mexico. But what kind of education could they receive? Well, while crafts were often taught to young children at home, public education was actually provided for in the city. Similar to those educational institutions in Europe, the Aztec schools were run by the clergy. Anyone at age 13 could join and receive an education in several different topics, depending on your gender and status. If you were a woman, then congrats, you get to learn how to weave. And that's pretty much it. If you're a man, however, you get to learn how to be a priest, or a merchant, or usually a warrior. Priests learned not just theology, but also the calendar and writing, many of the same functions played by the Christian clergy in Europe. Did I mention the Aztecs had pictographic writing? They did. More on that later, though. Warriors began a rigorous training process that eventually included accompanying an army to the battlefield, where the class of young teenagers might try to hunt down and capture an enemy straggler. By age 20, they needed a kill or a prisoner of their own. If this didn't happen, or if it was certainly clear that the boy couldn't be a warrior, they had to drop out and live the rest of their shameful lives doing the worst jobs of the city, like delivering water. Ugh. Tenochtitlan also contained its fair share of philosophers. Those who learned to read and write also pondered the bigger questions of the universe. The Tlamatenime, as they were known, wrote and maintained many codices, and also served as teachers for the school system. They did plenty of philosophizing themselves, though. Charles Mann discusses the works of one particular Aztec thinker, Nezahualoyotl. He quotes some of his works on mortality, saying this: "Not forever on earth, only a little while here. Be it jade, it shatters. Be it gold, it breaks. Be it a quetzal feather, it tears apart. Not forever on earth, only a little while here." Deep stuff. Written down on bark paper or deerskin, and usually in pictorial format, codices themselves contained information on all sorts of topics: religion, history, calendars, and much more. The Tlatoani of a particular city would keep libraries of these codices in his palace. In 1491, Charles Mann also says that upon the conquest of other cities, it was customary to burn codices to destroy an enemy's history. He also notes that Tlacaelel, an Aztec general, once convinced his own people to burn their own codices, saying, "It is not fitting that our people should know these pictures. Our people, our subjects will be lost and our land destroyed, for these pictures are full of lies. Perhaps Tlacaelel wanted to give the Aztecs a more fitting history, one less embarrassing for future generations. Unfortunately, the next time Aztec codices were burned, it would not be so willingly. The ones who would be doing the conquering and burning were the warriors of Tenochtitlan. The Aztec military was stratified into the commoners and nobility, though a commoner who distinguished himself in combat could actually be promoted to the place of honorary nobility. These nobles distinguished themselves from each other by entering warrior societies like those of the eagle and the jaguar. The nobles in warrior societies made themselves visually distinct by embodying the animal representative of their society. The jaguar warriors, for example, wore the skins of jaguars over their bodies, while the eagle warriors wore feathered and beaked helmets. No matter what your status, you dress colorfully and with equipment customary to your unit. This equipment naturally varied and was just as unique. For example, the macuahuitl, one of the more famous Aztec weapons, was essentially a wooden cricket bat with sharp obsidian blades on either side. And when I mean sharp, I mean really sharp, like more sharp than razor sharp. Also well known is the atlatl, or spear thrower, which is pretty self-explanatory. It was a sling which allowed your average skirmisher to throw a javelin or a spear at a much greater velocity than by hand. Though the majority of Aztec fighting men were levies, brought up when the time called for a fight, their empire required a more permanent force to maintain it. These guys acted as garrisons for rebellious cities or for certain fortifications spread out across the land. Also accompanying the armies were priests, who of course served the many functions listed above. You know, I talked quite a bit about sacrifices in the last episode, but I think it deserves a little more detail right now. Your most recognizable sacrifice involved cutting out the heart of someone atop a pyramid, then casting the body down the steps. The captive's skull would then be removed and cleaned up to be stored on a rack, while the rest of the body was burned. Sacrifices could also be burned to death, starved to death, flayed to death, or killed in a ritualistic battle. This sort of thing became increasingly common, not only as the Aztec Empire grew, but as the priests of the empire grew in number and power. They had quite a bit of influence by the days of Moctezuma II, so a constant stream of slaves needed to placate the clergy, and in so doing the gods. Their life force was needed to keep the world alive, just as the priests were needed to keep the empire alive. Lastly, I wanted to talk a little bit about Aztec food. If you've ever had Mexican food before, you already have a good idea of a lot of the same things that your average Mexica would have eaten back in the 15th century. Your average market goer could also find turkey, venison, rabbit, lobster, or frog meat, perhaps in a chili of some kind. They grew corn, beans, tamales, the works. Corn was perhaps the staple crop of the Aztecs, as it could be used to make tortillas, which had been popular for over 2,000 years. Let's also not forget chocolate, which was used as an after-dinner drink by those who could afford it. When the Mexica first arrived at the shores of Lake Texcoco in 1325, there was little land for them to grow these things on. The reason the area was relatively uninhabited was because there was very little arable land. It was all swampy lakeshore. The Mexica fixed this problem by using chinampas, island farms built in the manner I mentioned in the last episode, piling mud between wooden walls, draining the water all around them. Tons of chinampas surrounded Tenochtitlan, like a lot of them, and they were handy in feeding the local populace. However, by the time of Moctezuma I and his successors, the city had grown far too large to be self-sustaining, which is why food was often paid as tribute. That, I think, is where I'll leave off today. I hope you got a better mental image of this time and place, as things are about to change dramatically. In 1519, the Aztec Empire, with its huge cities, mighty military, and centralized bureaucracy were the greatest power in the known world. 2 years later, it would be completely subjugated to an empire thousands of miles away. Strange men have landed on the shores of the Yucatan, and their actions will bring Moctezuma and his people to their knees.